From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We turn our attention now to bloodsuckers.
I am Dracula.
I'm afraid I'm not as warm as the men that you must be accustomed to.
Do you still want death? Or have you tasted it enough?
Without me, Transylvania will be as exciting as Bucharest.
For decades, Americans have been fascinated with vampires on TV, the big screen, and in books. They're enjoying a particular resurgence these days, thanks to the HBO series True Blood and the wildly popular Twilight books and movies. But look closely.
Look closely, and you'll notice that our vampires now are very different from, say, the vampires of the 1980s or even the 1990s. That's because they reflect who we are as a culture and have changed with us over the years. So what is it about the spirit of the times that's making bloodsuckers so popular these days? NPR's Margot Adler has read 75 vampire novels in the last 7 months, and she was ready to take this one on.
I'll get to why I ended up reading 75 vampire novels later, but let's back up. First of all, while vampires have been a constant of folklore, our modern notion of the vampire came out of a particular cultural moment in a chalet in Switzerland in 1816. There, Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and John Polidori were doing a kind of literary exercise. Whitley Strieber, the author of 3 vampire novels, including The Hunger, says out of that moment came 2 things.
Frankenstein, the novel, and John Polidori's Vampire, which is the first vampire story in the English language. There's a reason that this happened. A shocking thing was occurring. Science was beginning to seem to be able to challenge the very nature of life itself.
Since then, vampires have been used again and again as a way to speak of things people fear.
It's almost this perfect empty vessel.
Eric Newsom is the author of The Dead Travel Fast, Stalking Vampires from Nosferatu to Count Chocula. He's also NPR's Director of Programming and Acquisitions.
If you want to understand any moment in time or cultural moment, just look at their vampires. And that really tells you a lot about them.
So, for example, take Bram Stoker's Dracula. It was written at the end of the 19th century at a time when England had some of the largest ports in the world. And here you have a ship that's arriving from Eastern Europe, bearing soil from another country, and a plague-like person who's going to bring death and destruction. Benita Blessing teaches modern European history at Ohio University. At that time, she says, people were concerned with foreign illnesses.
With issues like unwanted immigrants. So anything that might come in to one of the world's largest ports is all of a sudden a big fear. This is exactly what Dracula is all about. It's all about the fear of what we might today call globalization.
The famous Bela Lugosi film Dracula came out during the Great Depression in a time of great chaos.
There are far worse things waiting man than death.
Just as the surge of interest in vampires during the 1980s is usually attributed to the Cold War and spread of AIDS. That was the time of Anne Rice's Interview with a Vampire and Strieber's The Hunger. Strieber says it was a period when people were waiting for something to go wrong as the Soviet Empire was collapsing.
Would they push the button in a desperate attempt to survive? And this kind of entered the unconscious.
In fact, there were about 4 times as many vampire movies made in 1980 as 1990. It's almost as if when the Berlin Wall came down, there was just a lot less fear to write and think about. But what about now? Kimberly Pawley has written an incredibly funny vampire book for teens that turns the genre on its head. It's called It Sucks to Be Me. She believes vampires are attractive right now because we're in a time somewhat similar to the Depression.
We're in a time of chaos. You know, vampires are immortal. They're not hurt by the, you know, goings-on of everyday life. They kind of stand above it. And I think that's probably the most appealing factor about a vampire is that no matter what's going on in the world around you, you're going to make it through.
And full disclosure, that's probably why I ended up reading 75 vampire novels. I have a seriously ill loved one, and I've been spending a lot of time thinking deeply about issues of mortality and even fantasizing what it would be like not to have to think about that. But what I started noticing as I read all these novels and looked at all the recent shows is that the near immortality of vampires is not the most interesting thing going on. Almost all of them are struggling to be moral. And while it's conventional to talk about vampires as sexual, drinking blood and so forth, most of these modern vampires are not talking as much about sex as they are about power. Take this scene from the CBS show Moonlight, which aired for only one season, ending in 2008. Mick St. John is a very moral vampire private eye. You know the basic American notion that we have laws to keep our baser instincts in check? Well, here Mick St. John is unsuccessfully trying to reason with a new violent rogue vampire by telling him...
We have rules. There are no rules. I'm top of the food chain. These are people. They're human beings. You used to be a human.
You know, we're at the top of the food chain. We get to do what we want versus, you know, we were human. How can you just treat humans as if they're cattle?
Amy Smith is a professor of English at the University of the Pacific. Along with courses on Jane Austen and the literature of war, she teaches a course on vampires.
For me, the central question of so many vampire films and novels is, if you had power over other people, how would you use it? Which I think is why people keep going back to them. Because that's the tension we have in life. If you earn more money than other people, suddenly you find that you have power. How will you use it?
Power is a personal as well as global issue, says Smith. How do you treat someone you love?
We're always asking ourselves, how should we behave? The core question stays the same. Does might make right?
In True Blood, the HBO series based on the Sookie Stackhouse novels by Charlene Harris, vampires have become legal citizens drinking a form of synthetic blood. But that doesn't solve everything.
You don't like vampires, even though you are one.
I am a vampire. I am supposed to be tormented.
In this scene, Bill Compton, who was turned into a vampire after the Civil War, envies a young vampire teenager who does not have to confront an evil and violent past.
It's so different for her. When I was made, one had no choice but to live completely outside the human world. As an outlaw. A hunter.
Whether it's Bill Compton wanting to embrace his humanity in True Blood or the entire Cullen family in the Twilight Saga, they're all struggling to be moral, even though they are by nature predators. And who are we? Author Whitley Strieber says we humans are just a different kind of predator.
Our prey is our planet.
Today, he says the main fear isn't the Cold War or AIDS, it's ecological catastrophe.
We sense that there's something wrong with the environment, that the planet itself may not be able to sustain us very long, and we are beginning to romance death once again.
The New York Times columnist Ross Douthat wrote recently, "We are beasts with self-consciousness, predators with ethics, mortal creatures who yearn for immortality." Exactly. Maybe that's why vampires aren't really a fad, because except for that near immortality bit, they really are us. Margo Adler, NPR News.
You can find an annotated list of the 75 vampire books that Margo read at our website, npr.org.
We're getting a glimpse of what will be in fashion next fall at New York Fashion Week. And with the event comes the inevitable discussion of the size of the models. Size zeros and double zeros are still a common sight on the runway. But some fashion spreads of late have prominently featured plus-size models. That's what they call them. We reached Robin Givhan, fashion editor for The Washington Post, who's been writing on this very topic.
One of the things that's happened is that as the general population has gotten bigger and bigger, the models were getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So the fashion industry itself did create a health initiative. It was the Council of Fashion Designers of America. And the idea was to create a set of guidelines that designers could work with. And just recently in New York, they had a big panel discussion where a lot of these issues were brought up, and the key issue being the sample size, and essentially saying that's where all of this begins.
The sample size meaning the samples of clothes that show up on the runway, and the sample size is so teeny that only painfully thin women, if you want to say it that way, can fit into it.
Yeah, I mean, the sample size is what the designer creates for the runway show. And then when magazines have to photograph those clothes in advance of their going into stores, and we're talking 4 or 5 months in advance, the only way that they can photograph the clothes is to use the sample. So as a result, the models who are in the magazine have to be thin enough to fit into those clothes. Editors constantly say, oh, yeah, I would definitely use a larger model, except they don't fit the clothes that we're shooting.
Well, one of the criticisms when you get to the plus size models is that they aren't actually what many people would call plus size. I mean, they're like a size 12, which isn't tiny, but the average American is a size 14.
One also consider that the model is a size 12, but she's also about 5'10". There is a real disconnect between what the fashion industry considers to be a plus size model and what the average person considers to be plus size. I mean, a woman going into a department store is not going to be sized out of the most fashionable clothes until she gets to about a size 16.
Well, in your column on this topic, you do wonder when the image of plus size itself becomes an unhealthy message, the way now the image of emaciated models has been, as some say, sending out an unhealthy message.
I think we've gotten to a point at which our vision of what a healthy weight is has gotten very contorted. The fashion industry on one end is showing us these 14 and 15-year-old very thin girls and portraying them as women. And then on the other hand, there's the unhealthy nature of obesity and the sort of, in many ways, kind of politically correct aspect of saying, well, you should be happy with who you are and you should celebrate, we should celebrate all sizes. But I think what we have to figure out is how do we celebrate good health without stigmatizing people who are on either end of the spectrum and are still trying to work their way towards the middle ground, which is good health.
Robin Givhan is the fashion editor for The Washington Post. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
With just a little more than 2 weeks to go before the Oscars, Adam Shankman is a little stressed out. He's co-producing the Oscar telecast with Bill Mechanic, and neither of them has ever done this before. Mechanic and Shankman are making some changes this year. We asked Shankman to talk about what they're up to. He directed Bringing Down the House and the movie musical remake of John Waters' film Hairspray. He's also a choreographer who got his start dancing in and choreographing for music videos. He's a judge on the TV show So You Think You Can Dance. Adam Shankman, welcome back to Fresh Air. So the official Oscar poster says you've never seen Oscar like this. So what? Give us an example of something you're trying to do different from how it's been done.
The most obvious two things are that there are 10 nominees in the Best Picture category. And the morning of the nominations, Bill and I were basically dancing a jig because the nominees represented a true cross-section of, you know, the movie lovers' tastes. And, you know, to go from Hurt Locker and Education all the way to Avatar and Blindside to District 9. I mean, it just represents everybody. And so that's really, really thrilling. And how we're handling that is very smooth and elegantly and hopefully in a way that makes people want to go out and see the movies, whether they win or not. And then
is that why it's 10 nominees now, so that there's more more zets
opportunity
for movies,
more opportunity for popular
to be able to say nominated for an Oscar?
Well, it's not to be nominated for an Oscar. It's to say, come watch the show because a movie you've seen is on it. You know, Avatar really kicked that up because everybody's seen Avatar. So there's a real foot race there. There's actually a foot race between a couple in some of the categories, which, you know, it's really hard these days because there's so many award shows that come before the Oscars. They kind of cannibalize the Oscars and I think the specialness of the Oscars.
Yeah, they all say, well, we predict who the Oscar winner is going to be.
But yeah, I mean,
so how is that affecting what you want to do, given that we've already seen a lot of these people accept their awards,
that's
wear
actually,
their
that's
best
the,
costumes? And Yeah.
That's how it affects it, is that some actors say, like, you know what, I'm overexposed. I don't need to do the show. I don't want to do the show because I've been to the Golden Globes and the Grammys and the SAG Awards and the Haiti Tribute. And, you know, and so they just don't want to come on the show if they're not actually nominated. And it's horrible because that means they're not being part of their industry. It's the Super Bowl of the year.
So when you say they don't want to be on the show, you mean as presenters?
Yeah, as presenters. We have a few key players not in place right now. But we have our desired list. But there's a few key ones missing. We have almost everybody.
Right.
We have almost everybody.
Now, how did you choose Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin to host? They co-star in It's Complicated.
What happened was Bill Mechanic and I met, had lunch, and we first had a pretty radical idea about who we wanted to host the show, which the Academy swatted down. Because
you're not going to tell me who that was,
wild
right?
Card. You know what? I'm going to tell you. It was Sacha Baron Cohen.
Oh no!
They thought it was too big a wild card.
Oh,
they thought it was too unpredictable.
Oh, that what a good reason to watch.
Hello, that's my thing. I mean, you know, once you get hired to do the show, we don't control the nominations, we don't control the winners, but we control, you know, everything around all of that stuff. And our job is to put on the best show possible and really give the audience, not just the people in the room, but the viewing audience, the people who pay our bills, you know, a great, great evening.
I loved
the idea.
Yeah, if you had Sacha Baron Cohen hosting, you don't even know who'd be hosting. Because he might do it as one of his characters.
I know. I mean, it would just be spectacular. But I think the Academy felt like that. Not only is it unpredictable, but it could overshadow the nominees and all that. Then we immediately went to this idea of co-hosts. And the very cool thing about the co-host thing is that we didn't realize there haven't been co-hosts in this fashion since 1928, which was the first year of the show. And so that's another way that it's going to be very, very different, because they're going to share the duties. Their comedy is going to be very, very snappy. We all loved the way that Neil Patrick Harris did the Emmys, how he really kept them moving along. And Alec and Steve are going to be in there doing a lot of that stuff, too. But what the great thing was by having Steve, it anchors it in kind of a tradition. And he is one of the most beloved hosts of the show they've ever had. And then we thought Alec made a great comic wild card, and they bring out the funniest versions of themselves with each other. The chemistry between them is so magical. When I say it's like Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, I'm not kidding.
Are they going to sing?
I'm not going to tell you that.
Oh.
That would ruin a surprise.
So tell me one
Chipmunk.
Thing. That's our safe word.
That's our safe word when she starts going into territory that I'm not going to talk about. Chipmunk.
So last year, there were former winners of Oscars who read the names of the nominees and the Oscar. So you're doing that again this year, right?
We love the idea. We're doing something a little bit different with it. But in point of fact, something like that is going to be done. And it has to do, the way we're doing it has to do with a bit more of interconnectivity, because what was really, really stunning about last year, the way they did that, was the video clip buildup to the reveal of the stars. I mean, the editing of that stuff was so breathtaking and so big that when those screens went up and you saw the five walk out, you just like going, whoa, my God, it was so dramatic and beautiful. And then in many cases, the presenter then started talking about the person they were nominated, and they clearly didn't know who they were, basically. And they were, you know, there was very little connectivity in there. And I think that was because it was a great idea on Bill Condon and Larry Mark's part, that it sounds like it took, like, it didn't kick into high gear until later. And I think it was hard getting people to do it, actually. So we are taking the idea and playing with that.
All right. And you're not going to tell me how, but that's okay. I'll be watching.
No, that's fine. I mean, just know that it will be sort of maybe not as dramatic, but definitely a little more emotional.
I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this, but since we're talking about award shows, I'm wondering what you thought of the Grammys.
I thought that it was a very interesting try at a business that has been so ravaged because, you know, basically, I mean, it was what was so incredibly weird was they had an almost 4-hour show, it felt like, where they did 22 performances and gave out like 8 or 9 awards. And, you know, every time a person would come up or they'd introduce a person, they said, earlier today, so-and-so won 7 Grammys. And, you know, but it was serious, but their ratings went up 35%. So, you know, they were on to something with that. I personally thought they front-loaded some of the best acts too early into the show. And then some of the less energetic acts were a little too late in the show. They didn't pace it right for me personally. Sorry, Grammy people. But that's just my take on it. But, I mean, that is truly a reaction to an industry that has been devastated. I think that's what happened on that show.
Can I ask you something? I know you're a choreographer and director and producer and not a costume designer, but I think you'll still have an opinion on this. I feel like I'm so tired of seeing dancers in S&M fetish wear. Maybe especially after
Once again, that's a reaction. That comes from the old school video world of, you know, this is what is sexy. How do you show sexy without being overt? And, you know, I think a lot of people just go straight for overt and obvious because it's the easiest place to go. You know, it's not particularly creative. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of times you'll see them dressed like that when they're singing, even if it's like a song about a breakup. It's sort of strange. It's sort of like there's nothing in there that says like anything about lifestyle being that like crazy vinyl look, you know. But it is a very easy place for people to go to be overtly sexy. And so I think that's why it happens.
So since you're going to be backstage, do you have to worry about what to wear? Or?
Oh, my God. I'm so excited about what I'm wearing. You have no idea. Are you kidding? I am wearing the most beautiful. Tom Ford is making me.
No.
My clothes.
Oh, no.
Yes. I can't believe it. I saw it. I did my fitting, and I basically started to weep. It was like a clothing orgasm. It was unbelievable. It was so beautiful. So I'm very excited about what I'm going to be wearing. Because then, you know, afterwards, we have to go to the governor's ball and do our thing and either hang our heads in shame and leave in a stretcher or walk around like, you know, with our arms up like Invictus.
So do you want to describe what he made you?
What he made me? The tux? Oh, it's so cool. It's like from Casino. It's a little bit more of like the jacket. It's like this beautiful fabric. I feel so like superficial, but whatever. With these really beautiful silver threaded gold circles in it, in the tux jacket, and with this perfect fit. It's like cut to make me look like a superhero, basically. and then a shirt that basically was made by blind angels. It's so beautiful. The fabric is so brilliant. This big, beautiful, puffy black bow tie with a low cut black vest that has kind of ruching, if you know what that is, the texture of it, and then just, you know, gorgeous pants and gorgeous shoes and gorgeous everything. And I, you know, I'm going to put it in a glass case when I'm done, or you know, that's going to be my version of a wedding dress, you know, go in the box and I'll never to be touched again except on sad moments when I'm playing All by Myself by Eric Carmen, and I'll just open it and, you know, look at it.
So one last question. Now you're producing the Oscars, and 20 years ago you performed in a production number.
Under the Sea.
yes, and Under the Sea.
And the costume number. I was Baron Munchausen in the costume number. Yeah, there's no dignity.
So what's the difference in how it looks watching from home on television versus like being there on stage?
Its vibe is kind of actually gorgeous mid-century, and it's sexy. There's screens everywhere, and you know, being in the room. Well, first of all, being in the room, it's very hot, and it's not particularly comfortable, and you know, there's camera equipment all over the place, and you're there, and you're just watching. It's like going to a big Broadway show, you know, with a gigantic stage. And then, but being on the stage and looking out, basically, you see in the first 10 rows every movie star who's ever breathed, you know, it feels like. And you're close enough to touch Meryl Streep. So for these, it's crazy, you know. But I think I think it's actually nicer for the TV audience because it's just more comfortable. And there's also all these great games that you're going to be able to play this year because we've done so much work to create like interconnective tissue between the presenter and either the nominee or the winner or the tribute that I think it'll be fun for people to try to guess how the things are connected. There's a bit of a 6 degrees kind of a thing that we're doing.
Well, thank you, Adam Shankman. Thanks so much for talking with us. Good luck.
Thank you. I need it. Cross your fingers and watch. Just watch it. Watch for either the train wreck or for the fabulousness. That's what I think,
Adam Shankman is the co-producer of this year's Oscar telecast. He also directed the movies Bringing Down the House and the musical version of Hairspray. And he's a judge on So You Think You Can Dance. The Oscar ceremony is March 7th.
The theme for next month's Academy Awards ceremony appears to be more. There will be double the Best Picture nominees and double the hosts. But Bob Mondello says this is no way to make a long night shorter, so he offers this modest proposal.
As long as we're having categories with 10 nominees, I know how the Academy can save time, eliminate two acceptance speeches, and strike a blow against sexism all in one fell swoop. Just make the Oscars gender neutral. Nobody says best director and best directress, or best editor and best editress. So why best actor and best actress? Combine them and let the best performer win. I mean, seriously, who cares about Colin Firth versus George Clooney when you can pit Sandra Bullock against Jeff Bridges in a brawl of the drawls?
I don't need y'all to approve my choices, all right? But I do ask that you respect them.
I'm Bab Blake. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just gonna stay bad.
Now, I can just hear the objections to combining categories. Men get all the roles, they're higher paid, their pictures have bigger budgets. And let me concede most of that, but note that it's new. I'm guessing the Motion Picture Academy's original logic for separating the acting awards by gender was that if they hadn't, in the 1920s and 30s, Joan Crawford and Greta Garbo would have walked off with all the trophies. Take 1935. It was such a good year for the likes of Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, Merle Oberon, and Claudette Colbert that they had to add a sixth slot in the Best Actress category. The men, meanwhile, couldn't even field a full slate. Only four nominees, and the three who didn't win all came from one picture, Mutiny on the Bounty.
You're sending me to my doom, eh? I'll live to see you, all of you, hanging from the highest yardarm in the British fleet.
Who knows what they'd have done if the Bounty hadn't sailed until the following year. Yes, of course, the game has changed since then, but in a way that could actually work against men at Oscar time. Men monopolize blockbusters, which never win acting awards. You want that neutered gold statue these days. You have to play in what used to be called women's pictures, something more touchy-feely. Besides, acting's not like a shot-put competition. Body mass and physical strength don't give men an advantage when it comes to emoting effectively. I mean, look at this year's supporting actor nominees. No disrespect to Matt Damon's rugby playing, or Woody Harrelson's crying, Christopher Plummer's erudite dithering, or the respective killing styles of Stanley Tucci and Christoph Waltz, but not one of those guys would stand a chance if he had to compete with Monique's ferociously manipulative mom.
So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me? Who was going to make me feel good?
The Academy will almost certainly make Monique feel good on Oscar night, and that would be no less true if she were competing with the boys. I'm Bob Mondello.
The winner takes it all, the loser stands.